Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Well, this is a red letter day, I have to say. First of all, do you know the Library of America? They are a magnificent publisher of a series of American classics, all in uniform editions, all beautiful. And this week, I have the joy of talking about Peter Taylor, about Peter Taylor's short stories. Ann Beattie edited a two-volume set for Library of America because she knew Peter Taylor. Also here is the also magnificent writer Richard Bausch, who wrote an introduction to the previous collected stories. Peter Taylor, he's been passed over. He's been forgotten for, what would you say, a generation and a half?
Yes.
When did he die?
I believe he died in 1994.
Yeah.
And he stopped publishing in the New Yorker at a certain point. He decided that he would refuse to send stories there. And so he faded out of consciousness. I've been reading these 56 stories, and I'll tell you, he's a stunner. I mean, you let him disappear, you're going to miss one of the best American writers. He was a Southerner. He was taught by Alan Tate. He grew up in the company of John Crow Ransom, Randall Jarrell, who he lived with for a while. He was great, very erratic friends with the erratic Robert Lowell. And he wrote magnificent fiction, I think particularly the short stories, although he won a Pulitzer Prize for a novel called Summons to Memphis. First of all, Richard, how did you meet Peter Taylor?
I was 26. I was at George Mason. He came and visited. And I have to tell you that after I saw him and stood around and talked and watched him with other faculty and learned from his answers to the questions what he did and where he taught and all of that, I got in the car with my wife riding into town to a movie, and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to be a writer in a university. That's what I'm going to work toward.
Well, what was it about him?
Well, first of all, he had read everything. And when they asked questions, there was, you know, there was stuff, and he was funny. And there was just something so charming about him, and that lovely Middle Tennessee accent, and, you know, his graciousness, and the way he comported himself. And he was, you know, he was like this, the real thing, this writer. And I had been reading the stories.
And as I understand it, Ann Beattie, he went out of his way. He discovered you by reading your stories and said, I must know this woman. And he invited you down to the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, where he taught. And you were, what, 25?
Yes, I was 25. Well, what happened was that I was in graduate school then. I had finished my coursework, but I was hanging on. And I applied for 76 jobs, and this was before the days of the computer. So I had to write 75 letters on a manual typewriter. And the last six were to universities in the South. And the only person who pulled me and who immediately did want to interview me was that he and John Casey, who was his colleague at the time, and John is still at the University of Virginia, were the creative writing department, but it wasn't a special discrete department at that time. It wasn't the way it is now. And so I went there to apply for a job, and it was a one-year position to replace Peter because he wanted me there. He lived in Charlottesville with his wife, the poet Eleanor Ross.
Great poet,
yes. They talk about passed over. Let's get her right back into print, please, please, please.
And lots of fun to be around.
Yes, lots of fun to be around, too. Very different people. But when I did go to the University of Virginia, I don't usually say this, but I will say it now and maybe even surprise you. He sent me $100 so that I could drive from where I was living in Connecticut in a house with a bunch of other people. And he sent me gas money to come down to see if I would find him suitable.
Now, had you started publishing your stories yet?
I had two stories in small magazines, and I had two stories in national magazines, one in The Atlantic, one in The New Yorker. And John Casey had seen both of those, and Peter had seen the ones in the small magazine. So when they put their heads together, they said, why is this kid applying for an academic job?
Wow. And so this really was the beginning of Ann Beatty and one of the first recognitions by peers and elders that you received.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, you have just spent, I think, if I remember correctly, the last 3 years editing the collected stories of Peter Taylor. These are two volumes from the wonderful Library of America. These stories go from 1938 to 1992, and if I'm not mistaken, they include some stories that were never published before.
Yes, they do, including two or three very early stories that would have been in small publications that sometimes only had one issue.
They, being my teachers, they used to say about the short story that it was like one of those Chinese flowers that you put into water and the flower would open up and get bigger and brighter, and that the more time after you read the short story, the flower would be fully bloomed. The short stories lived in you after you completed them, and that they were like a gesture that needed the imagination to complete it. And very nicely said, but I never experienced it. I never experienced it. People would give me Chekhov. I didn't get it. They would give me the stories in The New Yorker. What was that about? And then one day, in the book that my guest Richard Bausch wrote an introduction to, the first story is a story called Dean of Men. I read the story. It stayed in my mind. I was curious about it. I wouldn't have guessed, because it's about a dean of men at a college, but it ultimately is about a dean of men. What is manliness? And also, what does it mean to be a father? And what does it mean to be a surrogate father? A huge subject that opened up only after I'd finished reading the story. And this seems to be one of the great gifts of Peter Taylor, that he actually produces, writes stories that have 20 or so pages that you will write afterwards in your head. Do you think that's accurate?
I think so. I mean, the way he talked about it a couple of times when I was around him, that the short story is a superior form of entertainment, and he says in what he likes to think of it as an evening's entertainment. Instead of looking at a movie or something, you read a story. And that what he wanted to provide as a writer was exactly that. Somebody could sit down and read it in an evening and then have it have its effect. And he said, and I hope that if it's good enough, it'll reverberate and it'll stay with him.
I am talking to Richard Bausch and Ann Beatty, both of whom have been involved in the production at one time and another of the stories of Peter Taylor. Richard Bausch wrote an introduction to a collected stories, and Ann Beatty has now edited the complete stories of Peter Taylor. Now, Richard Bausch's most recent book is a book of stories called Living in the Weather of the World. It's come out from Vintage. And Beatty's most recent book of stories, The Accomplished Guest, has been published by Scribner's. If Peter Taylor was a dean of writers, these are his inheritors. They are among the best people writing stories in America right now, and I'm honored to have the two of them in front of me. Now, you did to do this. You read the complete short stories of Peter Taylor. What did you conclude about him when you read all this work in a block?
I was totally amazed, even though I had been a great fan and, you know, often had an opportunity to speak to people about Peter's stories. I had no idea because, you know, very rarely does anybody have the opportunity to look at everybody, you know, somebody's early work in chronological order and read up to the point at which one stops reading. But I do have to rush in to say two things. Number one, I had nothing to do with making the decision, but I was overjoyed when there did not have to be stories excluded and Library of America decided to go for two volumes. They're all there. There are a couple of early ones that were such juvenilia that we mutually decided to leave them out. The other thing is that the person I worked with at Library of America at that time was a brilliant editor named Christopher Cardiff, and he's left now. He's still doing books, though, for the Library of America, doing editing for them. But he wrote the chronology, and, you know, I wrote the introduction to the book, and that did take quite a long time for me to sort out all the complexities and think, what is a fair way to approach Peter? What do I do? Because I really only have so many pages in which I can write the introduction. But I would urge anyone to look at the chronology and see, if you want to see how an American writer in those years made his way, it's all right there. And I had no sense of that either because, you know, I met him when I was 25. I wasn't going to ask him probing questions or, you know, give me your complete biography. He would have laughed and poured me another drink, right?
He was already in his 50s.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And he'd already had a heart attack when I met him. I mean, but that chronology is brilliant. God, is that fun reading. I mean, it really was. It was
Christopher Cardiff.
Now, Anne, in particular, this is a very good introduction, but you hate writing critical prose. This must have been murder.
Yeah, it was murder. But you know, you'd think having done that, that now I'm giving some talks about Peter Taylor. And, you know, as my husband said to me, will you ever be done with Peter Taylor? I find that I get worse and worse because, as you were saying before, one of the wonderful effects of reading Peter Taylor is that it does has this really wonderful sort of undertow when you're reading, but then this backlash when you've finished. And so you're always destabilized in a very fascinating way when you're trying to sort things out. And so I find it next to impossible now to write a 10 or 12 page essay about Peter that I would deliver publicly. I just don't know where to begin anymore.
Well, that's a brilliant introduction. It is so...
Oh, thank you.
Even for somebody who's, you know, familiar with the work and comes back and back to it, it was like an education on how to read him. I went back to a couple of the stories, like Venus, Cupid, Folly, and Time.
We all went
just
there.
Just repair do, you know.
Yes.
Just what Anne said about him, I went, oh, I'm going in there and look for that, you know, and there it is. It's so great. That's the companionableness of good criticism.
Yes.
It's somebody that knows the book and is talking about the book and you know, is willing to give over to it. And, God, that's fun.
The day before yesterday, I got a big package in the mail, and I got Thomas McGuane's Collected and New Stories under the title Cloudbursts. It's published by Knopf. I open it up, and, of course, there's an epigraph. It's an epigraph from one of Peter Taylor's greatest stories. The story is called The Old Forest, and the epigraph might as well be, I can't think of a shorter description of what Peter Taylor does in his stories. This is the epigraph. The world was still changing, preparing people for one thing and giving them another. Now, if there's something this story does, is prepare you for one thing and give you not just another, but another and another and another and another. I was reading what I thought was a story about a missing old lady. She takes off in her car. It's a famous story. First appeared in the New Yorker. It's called, I think, Miss Leonora When Last Seen.
I love that story.
It's a great story. But at first, okay, the narrator is the kind of person who calls someone an old maid. But that's not Peter Taylor who's saying that. And he seems to be talking about one of his favorite school teachers, the school teacher who made him feel special. But as he continues to talk, this lady is not pleasant at all. And this story is haunted by racism and sexism. Before we had those words, Peter Taylor was lifting up the shards and holding them to the light and saying, "Oh, look, you know, we don't treat our people very well. The world offers one thing and gives you another. Look at Miss Leonora. You may never see her again."
Or the spinster in Spinster's Tale.
Yeah. I mean,
going to that mirror and saying, "Away, away," over and over again.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ann Beatty and Richard Bausch. They have been involved with the stories of Peter Taylor. Ann Beatty has edited the complete stories, and Richard wrote an introduction to the selected stories. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with the great writers Ann Beatty and Richard Bausch about the stories of Peter Taylor, particularly celebrating the publication by the Library of America of the complete stories of Peter Taylor, edited by Ann Beatty. The 59 short stories, two volumes, coming in a beautiful box, and not expensive.
No.
It's a nice surprise, especially at a time when we're sort of losing track of our Southern writers. They were handling such, what would you say, radioactively ignitable material that a lot of the time it's very hard right now in our current cultural environment to go back to a previous understanding of racism, of slavery, and the whole history is concurrent with the stories of Peter Taylor. There's a story that we've mentioned called The Old Forest. That quote from The Old Forest, which I read you, which might as well be a signature for the Peter Taylor story. The world was still changing, preparing people for one thing and giving them another. Can you tell me about The Old Forest, Ann?
Yeah. The Old Forest is about a young man on the eve of his wedding who is with a girl that is not his fiancé, and they're involved because of his pig-headedness in an accident. And the car goes off the road, and the door springs open, and Leanne Dehart, read Dearheart, his dear heart, goes running into the woods, disappears, and suddenly, as happens so often with Peter Taylor stories, on some level they become a mystery because she simply doesn't reappear. And so
she doesn't come back. They go searching for her.
They have to go searching for her because the wedding cannot
the
go forward
will not
unless
go
it,
forward
she has
unless they find
come
her.
To no harm. There's no scandal, et cetera, et cetera. But when they do go looking, it's the woman that he's engaged to who really is the one who goes into the boarding house where Leanne used to be, who talks to Leanne's friends, et cetera. And that's one thing. But as we get into the very last few pages of the story, there's this amazing wild ride that they take in which the reader comes to understand that Carolyn, to whom he's engaged, wants nothing but to get away from the oppression of this society, even her role in it, even the marriage by, you know, inference. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. She just says, drive, 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 get out of here. The young man, his name is Nat, thanks her, in effect, aloud at the end, saying, you know, it was because of her power that I was allowed to lead a different life than the life of my parents.
It's astounding.
She's the force.
Because in Peter Taylor's stories, there's usually a mystery, and the mystery has something to do with how to become an outsider, no longer to be a part of the aristocracy of the South. People find their way to escape. I was talking to Richard Bausch before about the very famous story, Venus, Cupid, Folly, and Time. Mm-hmm. It's named from the title of a painting by Bronzino, but it is about incest. And if there's anything that even Southern cultured society has to cope with, it's generations of incest. And the fact that the children of the society are aware of the incestuous previous generations. So the story takes us into the heart of how the secret of incest is revealed among the young in order to set them free. But the setting free in this story is a terrible imprisonment. It leads to a brother who will never speak to his sister again because he loves her so much, because incest is what was revealed to him in the imagery of the story. Wow.
The thing about it to me is, and it's so much of Peter's work, so much of Peter's work takes place across the canvas of it. His major preoccupation really is evil. And where these people are, you know, whatever their adjustments are to the culture they live in has to do with what comes of that, that ends up being evil. Those two people in that house have been abandoned by their, you know, their parents. They've just gone off to their own things. And there they are alone in the house. And when you're first reading the story, they don't seem to be doing any harm. It's just a nice party and everybody's, you know, but there's this undercurrent, this mass of meaning that has to do with evil. And it's in all of them. I mean, every one of them.
He takes you places that you don't suspect you're going to get. And then you have to survive having been brought there. I don't know many short story writers who do that to you, or at least many are trying, but Peter Taylor succeeds more often in his best stories in changing the way you look at the world you just witnessed in the story and now the world around you that is changed as a consequence of the story.
The other thing that seems so interesting to me, speaking of Venus, Cupid, Folly, and Time, though, is that the background, the artifacts, the artwork that's alluded to, those are real things within the story. But in that story and in a lot of others, part of the way that Peter, I think, manages to haunt the reader is that they also seem in some way like dreamscapes. You know what I mean? It seems like if you were dreaming and these things popped up, what would they mean? What would they mean? And so it's a case where he's giving enough information that the reader is always on the outside interpreting, but these things go inward. They keep going inward. And that's what's so spooky, I think, for us as readers.
You know, the two guests I have are among my favorite writers, and in particular, Anne Beattie is my favorite interviewee. I always love talking to her because she writes from so deeply inside her unconscious that answering a question of the sort that I ask is really a labor for her, and whatever her answer will be, it will be a surprise. Writers used to say, I can't talk about my work, particularly poets. I wrote it the way I wrote it because there was no other way to write it. And that's absolutely true. And subsequently, we entered a culture that I'm part of, an interviewing culture that asks writers to do for us what we should be doing for ourselves, which is reading hard and deeply and seeing how far we can take our perception of a story. Ann Beattie, for some reason, has been my torchbearer in the writing of short stories. Although she was famous immediately and branded as the voice of a generation, she is still, to my mind, one of the fascinating story writers. Her book of stories recently about Maine, was it called The State We're In?
Yes.
I put Ann Beattie anywhere, and you're going to find a series of revelations that you could not have anticipated. Richard Bausch, too, is a writer that I started reading more recently. I started reading him with his own collected stories. He has edited short stories for the Norton anthologies. He's sort of like an emperor of the short story. He's been, you know, ruling over a province, a very large province, without sufficient recognition. I mean, it's an occasion for celebration when a book by Richard Bausch appears. And I love the fact that he lives near enough to Los Angeles for me now to talk to him with some frequency. I've been talking to Ann Beattie and Richard Bausch, but we've been talking about the stories of a mentor figure, the marvelous Peter Taylor, Southern writer who deserves to have to share the platform with William Faulkner and Eudora Welty, and will, thanks to these volumes of Library of America. I thank you both for joining me.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Our pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the complete stories of Peter Taylor at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer, the technical director, Mario Diaz, and thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.